I think back to Mr. Preston's uncharitable comment about frogs and princes. It occurs to me how easy it is to misjudge people. Even an upstanding man like Mr. Preston can sometimes get it wrong. Minus the smooth chest, Rodney entirely lacks amphibious qualities. My chiefest hope is that while he is not a frog, Rodney will turn out to be the prince of my very own fairy tale. I wonder to myself what the etiquette is around wait times before I dial Rodney's phone number. Should I call him immediately to thank him for our date, or should I wait until tomorrow? Perhaps I should text him instead. My only experience with such matters was with Wilbur, who despised talking on the phone and used text messages for time or task-related correspondence only. Expected arrival time, 7:03. Bananas on sale, 49 cents. Buy while quantities last. If Gran were still around, I'd ask for advice. But that is no longer an option. As I approach my building, I notice a familiar figure standing outside the front doors. For a moment, I'm sure I'm hallucinating. But as I get closer, I see it really is her. She's wearing her large dark sunglasses and carrying her pretty yellow purse. "Giselle?" I say as I approach. "Oh, thank God, Molly, I'm so glad to see you." Before I can say anything else, she opens her arms and hugs me tight. I'm at a loss for words, mostly because I can barely breathe. She releases me, tips her sunglasses back so I can see her red-rimmed eyes. "Can I come in?" "Of course," I say. "I can't believe you're here. I'm so pleased to see you."
"Not as pleased as I am to see you," she says.
I rummage through my pockets and manage to find my keys. My hands shake a little as I open the door and invite her into my building. She steps in gingerly and looks around the lobby. Crumpled flyers litter the ground, surrounded by muddy footprints and cigarette butts. Such a filthy habit. Her face registers disdain at the mess, so much so that I can read it clearly. It's unfortunate, isn't it? I do wish every tenant would participate in keeping the entrance clean. I think you'll find my apartment much more sanitary, I say. I guide her through the entrance and toward the stairwell. She looks up at the looming staircase.
"What floor are you on?" she asks.
"Fifth," I say.
"Can we take the elevator?"
"I do apologize. There isn't one."
"Wow," she says.
But she joins me in marching up the stairs, even though she's wearing impossibly high heels. We make it to the fifth landing, and I rush ahead of her to open the broken fire door. It creaks as I pull it. She steps through, and we emerge onto my floor. I'm suddenly aware of the dim lighting and burnt bulbs, the peeling wallpaper, and the general tattiness of these corridors. Of course, Mr. Rosso, my landlord, hears us approach and chooses precisely that moment to emerge from his apartment.
"Molly," he says, "on your good grand's grave. When are you going to pay me what's owed?"
I feel a blast of heat rise to my face. "This week, rest assured, you'll get what's coming to you." I imagine a big red bucket full of soapy water and pushing his bulbous head into it. Giselle and I keep walking by him. Once we're past, she rolls her eyes comically, which to me is a great relief, since I was concerned she'd think poorly of me for not keeping up with my rent. Clearly, that's not what she's thinking at all. I put my key in the lock and shakily open my front door. "After you," I say. Giselle walks in and looks around. I step in behind her, not knowing where to stand. I close the door and slide the rusty deadbolt across. She takes in Gran's paintings in the entry, ladies lounging by lazy riversides, eating picnic delicacies from a wicker basket. She spots the old wooden chair by the door with Gran's needlepoint pillow on it. She picks it up in both hands. Her lips move as she reads the Serenity Prayer.
"Huh," she says. "Interesting."
Suddenly, right there in the doorway, her face contorts into a grimace and tears fill her eyes. She hugs the pillow to her chest and begins to sob quietly. My shaking gets worse. I'm at a total loss. Why is Giselle at my house? Why is she crying? and what am I supposed to do? I put my keys down on the empty chair.
There's nothing you can ever do but your best, I hear Gran say in my head.
Giselle, are you upset because Mr. Black is dead? I ask. But then I remember that most people don't appreciate this kind of direct talk.
Sorry, I say, correcting myself. What I mean is, I'm sorry for your loss.
You're sorry? Why? She asks between sobs.
I'm not sorry. I'm not sorry at all.
She puts the pillow back in its place, pats it once, then takes a deep breath. I remove my shoes, wipe the bottoms with the cloth from the closet, and put them away. She watches me.
Oh, she says. I guess I should take these off.
She removes her glossy black heels with the red bottoms. Heels so tall, I have no idea how she made it up those 5 flights of stairs. She gestures for me to hand her the cloth.
No, no, I say. You're my guest.
I take her shoes, which are fine and sleek, a delight to hold, and I tuck them away in the closet. She takes in our cramped quarters, her eyes traveling up to the flaking living room ceiling, where circular stains bleed through from the apartment above.
Don't mind appearances, I say. There's not much I can do when it comes to how those above conduct themselves.
She nods, then wipes the tears from her cheeks. I rush to the kitchen, grab a tissue, and bring it to her.
A tissue for your issue? I say.
Oh my God, Molly, she replies. You've got to stop saying that when people are upset. They take it the wrong way.
I only meant...
I know what you meant, but other people won't.
I'm quiet for a moment as I take this in, storing her lesson in the vault of my mind. We're still in the entranceway. I'm frozen in my spot, unsure of what to do next, what to say. If only Gran were here.
This is the part where you invite me into the living room, Giselle says. You tell me to make myself at home or something like that.
I feel the butterflies in my stomach. I'm sorry, I say. I don't have company very often, or ever. Gran used to invite select friends round from time to time, but since she died, it's been rather quiet here. I don't tell her that she's the first guest to pass through the door in 9 months, but that's the God's honest truth. She's also the first guest I've ever entertained on my own. Something occurs to me. My Gran always said, "A good cup of tea will cure all ills, and if it doesn't, have another. Would you like one?"
Sure,
she says.
Can't remember the last time I had tea.
I hurry to the kitchen to put the kettle on. I peek at Giselle from the doorway as she strolls around the living room. I'm glad that it's Tuesday, as I just washed the floors last night. At least I know they are clean to perfection. Giselle walks over to the windows at the far end of the living room. She touches the frilled trim on Gran's flowery curtains, curtains she sewed herself many years ago. As I place tea in the pot, Giselle moves to Gran's curio cabinet. She crouches to admire the Swarovski menagerie, then takes in the framed photos angled on top. It makes me slightly uncomfortable, but also a tad giddy that she's here in my home. While I'm confident that the apartment is clean, it's not appointed in the manner to which a woman of Giselle Black's station would be accustomed. I don't know what she's thinking. Perhaps she's horrified by the way I live. It is not like the hotel at all. It is not grand. This has always been fine by me, but perhaps it's not fine by her. It's a discomforting thought. I pop my head out of the kitchen. Please rest assured that I maintain the highest level of sanitation at all times in this apartment. Unfortunately, on a maid's salary, I'm not able to purchase extravagant items or keep up with modern decor trends. I'm sure to you this home appears dated and old-fashioned, perhaps a little worn.
Molly, you have no idea how things appear to me. You don't really know much about me. You think I've always lived like I do now? Do you know where I'm from?
Martha's Vineyard, I say.
No, that's just what Charles tells everyone. I'm actually from Detroit, and not the nice side of town. This place actually reminds me of home. I mean, Home from long ago. Home before I found myself all alone. Before I ran away and never looked back.
I watch from the kitchen doorway as she leans in to inspect a photo of Gran and me taken over 15 years ago. I was 10 years old. Gran enrolled us both in a baking class. In this shot, we're wearing comically large chef hats. Gran is laughing, though I look very serious. I recall being displeased by the flour dusted on our pantry table. It was all over my hands and apron. Giselle picks up the photo next to it.
"Whoa," she says. "Is this your sister?"
"No," I say. "It's my mother. It was taken a long time ago."
"You look exactly like her."
I'm well aware of our resemblance, especially in that photo. Her hair is shoulder length and dark, framing her moon face. Gran always loved that photo. She called it her twofer because it reminded her of the daughter she lost and the granddaughter she gained.
"Where does your mom live now?"
"She doesn't," I say. "She's dead, along with my grandmother." The water is boiling. I turn off the element and pour the water into a teapot.
"Mine are gone too," she says, "which is why I left Detroit."
I place the pot on Gran's best and only silver serving tray alongside two proper porcelain cups and two polished teaspoons, a double-eared, cut crystal sugar bowl, and a small, antique pitcher of milk. All of these items store memories. Gran and I foraging in secondhand shops, or picking through boxes of discarded items left outside the row of austere mansions on the Caldwell Street.
"I'm sorry about your mother," Giselle says. "And your grandmother."
"You have no reason to be. You didn't have anything to do with it."
"I know I didn't, but that's just what you say, like you did with me at the door. You said you were sorry about Charles. You offered your condolences."
"But Mr. Black died yesterday, and my mother died many years ago."
"It doesn't matter," Giselle says. "It's just what you say."
"Thank you for explaining."
"Sure, anytime."
I truly am grateful for her guidance. With Gran gone, much of the time I feel like a blind person in a minefield. I'm constantly stumbling upon social improprieties hidden under the surface of things. But with Giselle around, I feel like I'm wearing a breastplate and I'm flanked by an armed guard. One of the reasons why I love working at the Regency Grand is that there's a rulebook for conduct. I can rely on Mr. Snow's training to tell me how to act, what to say when, how, and to whom. I find it relieving to have guidance. I take the tea tray into the sitting room. It rattles in my hands. Giselle sits down on the worst part of the sofa, where the springs poke through a tad, though Gran has covered them with a crocheted blanket. I sit beside her. I pour two cups of tea. I pick up mine, the one rimmed with gold and decorated in daisy chains, then realize my error. "Sorry, would you prefer this cup or that one? I'm used to taking the daisies. Gran would take the English cottage scene. I'm a bit of a creature of habit."
"You don't say," Giselle says, and picks up Gran's cup.
She helps herself to two heaping teaspoons of sugar and some milk. She stirs the contents. She's never done much housework, that's for sure. Her hands are smooth and flawless, her manicured nails long and polished blood red. Giselle takes a sip, swallows.
"Listen, I know you're probably wondering why I'm here."
"I was worried for you, and I'm glad you're here," I say.
"Molly, yesterday was the worst day of my life. The cops were all over me. They took me to the station. They questioned me like I'm some kind of common criminal."
"I was worried that would happen. You don't deserve that."
"I know, but they don't. They asked me if I got too eager as a potential heir to Charles's estate. I told them to talk to my lawyers, not that I have any. Charles handled all of that. God, it was awful to be accused of such a thing. Then as soon as I got back to the hotel, Charles's daughter, Victoria, called me."
I feel a tremor jolt me as I pick up my teacup and take a sip. "Ah, yes, the 49% shareholder."
"That's what she owned before. Now she'll own over half of everything, which is what her mother always wanted. Women in business don't mix, Charles says. Said. According to him, women can't handle dirty work.
That's preposterous, I say. Then I catch myself. Apologies. It's rude to talk ill of the dead.
It's okay. He deserves it. Anyhow, his daughter said way worse things to me on the phone. You know what she called me? Her father's Prada parasite. His midlife mistake, not to mention his killer. She was raging so much, her mother took the phone away from her. Calm as anything, Mrs. Black, the first Mrs. Black, says, I apologize for my daughter. We all react to grief in different ways. Can you believe it? While her lunatic daughter is yelling in the background, telling me to watch my back.
You don't have to worry about Victoria, I say.
Oh, Molly, you're so trusting. You have no idea how vicious it is out there in the real world. Everyone wants to see me go down. It doesn't matter that I'm innocent. They hate me. And for what? The police, they suggested that I was violent against Charles. Unbelievable.
I watch Giselle carefully. I remember the day she told me about Mr. Black's mistresses, how she was so angry she really did want to kill him. But thought and action are different things. They're different things entirely. If anyone knows this, I do.
The police think I killed my own husband, she says.
For what it's worth, I know you didn't.
Thank you, Molly, she says.
Her hands are shaking like mine are. She sets her cup down on the table.
I'll never get how a decent woman like Charles's ex-wife could raise such a bitch of a daughter.
Perhaps Victoria takes after her father, I say. I remember Giselle's bruises and how they came to be. My fingers tighten on the delicate handle of my teacup. If I grip it any harder, it will shatter into a million pieces.
Breathe, Molly. Breathe.
Mr. Black, he wasn't good to you, I say. He was, in my estimation, a very bad egg. Giselle looks down at her lap. She smooths out the edges of her satin skirt. She is picture perfect. It's as if a cinema star from the Golden Age just crawled out of Grand's TV and magically took a seat beside me on the sofa. That thought seems more probable than Giselle being real, a socialite who is actually friends with a lowly maid.
Charles didn't always treat me well, but he loved me, in his way. And I loved him in my way. I did.
Her big green eyes fill with tears. I think of Wilbur, how he stole the Fabergé. Any fondness I felt for him turned to bitterness in an instant. I would have cooked him in a vat of lye if I could have done so without repercussion. And yet Giselle, who has just cause to hate Charles, holds on to her love for him. How curious, the way different people react to similar stimuli. I take a sip of tea. Your husband was a cheater, and he beat you, I say.
Wow. Are you sure you don't want to tell it like it is?
I just did, I say. She nods.
When I met Charles, I thought my life was made. I thought I'd finally found someone who would look after me, who had it all and who adored me. He made me feel special, like I was the only woman in the world. Things were okay for a while, until they weren't. And yesterday, we had a huge fight right before you came in to clean the suite. I told him I was sick of our life. Sick of going from city to city, hotel to hotel, all for his business. I said, why can't we just settle down somewhere, like at the villa in the Caymans, and just live and enjoy life like normal people? People don't know this, but when we got married, he made me sign a prenup so none of his properties or assets belonged to me. It hurt that he didn't trust me, but like an idiot, I signed it. From that moment on, things were different between us. The second we were married, I wasn't special anymore, and he was free to give me what he wanted and take it away at any time. That's exactly what he's done throughout our 2 years of marriage. If he liked the way I acted, gifts would be showered upon me. Diamonds and designer shoes, exotic trips. But he was a jealous man. If I so much as laughed at a guy's joke at a party, I'd be punished. And not just by him turning off the money tap.
One of her hands flits up to her collarbone.
I should have known. It's not like I wasn't warned.
Giselle pauses, gets up, and retrieves her purse by the door. She rummages around and her hand emerges with two pills. She sets her purse down on the chair by the door, returns to the sofa, and pops the two pills in her mouth, washing them down with some tea.
Yesterday, I asked Charles if he would consider canceling our prenup, or at least putting the Cayman Villa in my name. We've been married for 2 years. He should trust me by now, right? All I wanted was a place to escape to when the pressure gets too much for me. I told him, you can keep growing your business if that's what you want, your black empire, but at least give me the deed to the villa, with my name on it, a place to call my own, a home.
I think back to the itinerary I saw in her purse. If the trip was for her and Mr. Black, why were the flights one way?
He lost it on me when I said the word home. He said everyone always lies to him, tries to steal his money, takes advantage of him. He was drunk, storming around the room, saying I was just like his ex-wife. He called me a lot of things, a money grabber, a gold digger, a dime store whore. He got so mad that he pulled off his wedding ring and threw it across the room. He said, fine, have it your way. Then he opened the safe, rooted around in there, stuffed some paper in his suit pocket, then pushed past me and stormed out of the room.
I knew what that paper was. I'd seen it in his pocket. The deed to the villa in the Caymans.
Molly, that's when you came in the suite. Remember?
I did remember. The way Mr. Black pushed past me. Just another aggravating human obstacle in his path.
Sorry I was acting so weird. Now you know why.
That's quite all right, I say. Mr. Black was far ruder than you were, and to be honest, I thought you were sad, not mad. She smiles.
You know what, Molly? You understand more than anyone gives you credit for.
Yes, I say.
I don't care what anyone else thinks. You're the best.
I can feel my face flush at the compliment. Before I have a chance to ask what other people think about me, a strange transformation washes over Giselle. Whatever is in the pills she just took, the change happens quickly. It's like she's turning from solid to liquid before my eyes. Her shoulders relax, and her face softens. I remember Gran when she was sick, how the medications relieved the pain just like this, for a while at least, how her face would turn from a tight, stony grimace to a look of peaceful bliss, so clear that even I could read it instantly. Those pills worked magic on Gran. Until they didn't. Until they weren't enough. Until nothing was enough. Giselle turns to face me and sits cross-legged on the couch. She wraps Gran's blanket around her legs.
You found him, right? Charles. It was you who first found him.
It was me. Yes.
And they took you to the station? That's what I heard.
Correct.
So, what did you tell them?
She brings one hand to her lips and nibbles at the skin by her index finger. I want to tell her that nail biting is a filthy habit and not to ruin her lovely manicure, but I refrain. I told the detective what I saw. How I entered the suite to return it to a state of perfection, how I felt perhaps it was occupied, how I entered the bedroom to find Mr. Black lying on the bed. And when I investigated further, I realized he was dead.
And was there anything weird about the suite?
He'd been drinking, I say, which I'm afraid I don't consider unusual for Mr. Black.
You got that right, she says.
But your pills, they're usually in the bathroom, and they were on the bedside table, open, with some spilled onto the carpet. Her whole body stiffens.
What?
Yes, and some pills had been stepped on and were ground into the carpet, which is problematic for those of us who have to clean the suite after. I wish she wouldn't nibble her nails like a cob of corn.
Anything else?
Giselle asks. The safe was open. Giselle nods.
Of course. Normally he kept it locked, never gave me the code. But that day he took whatever it was he wanted and left it open when he stormed out.
She picks up her teacup and takes a polite sip.
Molly, did you tell the police anything about Charles and me? About our relationship?
No, I say.
Did you tell them anything about me?
I did not hide the truth, I say, but I also didn't volunteer it. Giselle stares at me for a second, then leaps forward and hugs me, which catches me off guard. I can smell her expensive perfume. Isn't it interesting how luxury has an unmistakable scent, as unmistakable as fear or death?
Molly, you're a very special person. You know that?
Yes, I know, I say. I've been told that before.
You're a good person and a good friend. I don't think I could ever be as good as you, so long as I live. But I want you to know something. Whatever happens, don't you think for a second that I don't appreciate you.
She pulls back from me and springs to her feet. A few minutes ago, she was willowy and relaxed. Now she's overcharged. What are you going to do, now that Mr. Black is dead?
Not much, she says. The police won't let me go anywhere until the toxicology and autopsy reports are complete. Because if some rich guy turns up dead, then obviously his wife offed him, right? Couldn't be that he died of natural causes, of the stress he caused himself and everyone else around him. Stress that his wife was trying to relieve him from so he wouldn't drop dead.
Is that what you think happened? He dropped dead? Just like that? She sighs. Tears spring to her eyes.
There are so many reasons a heart can stop beating.
I feel a lump in my throat. I think of Gran, of her good heart, and how it came to a stop. Will you continue to stay at the hotel while you wait for the reports? I ask.
I don't have much choice. I've got nowhere else to go. And I can barely step outside of the hotel without being mobbed by reporters. I don't own any property. I've got nothing that's mine and only mine, Molly. Not even a crappy apartment like this.
She winces.
Sorry. See? You're not the only one who steps in it from time to time.
That's quite all right. I take no offense. She reaches out and puts a hand on my knee.
Molly, she says. I won't know what Charles's will says for a while, which means I won't know what becomes of me for a while. Until then, I'll stay at the hotel. At least there the bill is already paid.
She pauses, looks at me.
Will you look after me? At the hotel, I mean. Will you be my maid? Sunitha is nice and all, but it's not the same. You're like a sister to me, you know that? A sister who sometimes says crazy shit and likes dusting way too much, but a sister nonetheless.
I'm flattered that Giselle thinks of me in such a positive light, that she sees past what others don't, that she sees me as family. I'd be honored to look after you, I say, if Mr. Snow is fine with it.
Great. I'll tell him when I go back.
She stands, walks to the door, and grabs her yellow purse. She brings it to the sofa and takes out a stack of bills, a stack that looks all too familiar. She flicks off two crisp $100 bills and places them on Grand's silver tea tray.
For you,
she says.
You earned it.
What? This is a lot of money, Giselle.
I never tipped you yesterday. Consider this your tip.
But I never finished cleaning the suite yesterday.
That's not your fault. You just keep that, and let's pretend this conversation never happened.
I, for one, will never be able to forget this conversation, but I don't say that out loud. She stands and turns to the door, but then stops and faces me.
One more thing, Molly. I've got a favor to ask of you.
I immediately wonder if this will involve ironing or laundry, so I'm surprised by what comes next.
Do you think you might be able to get into our suite still? It's cordoned off right now, but I left something in there, something I desperately need back. I tucked it up in the bathroom fan.
That explains it. The clunky sound I heard yesterday when she was in the bathroom, showering. What is it you want me to retrieve?
My gun, she says, her voice neutral and calm. I'm at risk, Molly. I'm vulnerable now that Mr. Black is gone. Everyone wants a piece of me. I need protection. I see, I reply. But in truth, this request produces raging anxiety. I feel my throat closing. I feel the world tilt around me. I think of Mr. Snow's advice. When a guest asks for something above and beyond, consider it a challenge. Don't dismiss it. Rise to meet it. I'll do my best, I say, but the words catch. To retrieve your item. I stand in front of her, at attention.
Bless your heart, Molly Maid, she says, throwing her arms around me again. Don't believe what anyone says. You're not a freak, or a robot. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. You'll see. I swear I won't forget.
She rushes over to the front door, retrieves her glossy high heels from the closet, and slips them on. She's left her teacup behind on the table rather than carrying it to the kitchen as Gran would have. She has not, however, forgotten her yellow purse, which she slings over her shoulder. She opens my front door, blows me a kiss, and waves goodbye. A thought occurs to me. Wait, I say. She's down the hall, nearly at the stairs. Giselle, how did you know where to find me? How did you get my home address? She turns around.
Oh, she says. Someone at the hotel gave it to me.
Who? I ask. She squints.
Can't quite remember. But don't worry. I won't bug you all the time or anything. And thanks, Molly, for the tea, for the talk, for being you.
And with that, she flicks her sunglasses down, pulls open the broken fire door, and leaves. Wednesday. Chapter 10. My alarm clock rings the next morning. It's the sound of a rooster crowing. Even all these months later, I hear Gran's feet padding down the hallway, the gentle rap of her knuckles on my door. Rise and shine, my girl. It's a new day. Shuffle, 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 as she busies herself in the kitchen, making us English breakfast tea and crumpets with marmalade. But no, it isn't real. It's only a memory. I push the button on my alarm to stop the crowing and immediately check my phone just in case Rodney texted me overnight. Messages. Nil. I put my 2 feet flat on the parquet floor. No matter. I will go to work today. I will see Rodney there. I will take the temperature of our relationship. I will move things forward. I will help Giselle because she's a friend who needs me. I will know just what to do. I stretch and get out of bed. Before doing anything else, I pull off all the sheets and the quilt to make the bed properly. If you're going to do something, do it right. Very true, Gran. I start with the top sheet, snapping it crisply and replacing it on the bed. Tuck, tuck, hospital corners. Next, I sort Gran's quilt, smoothing it neatly, pointing the star north as always. I fluff up the pillows, placing them against the headboard at a regimented 45-degree angle, 2 plump hillocks with crochet fringe. I go to the kitchen and prepare my own crumpets and tea. I notice the grating sound of my teeth against the crust every time I take a bite. Why is it that when Gran was alive, I never heard the horrible sounds I make? Oh, Gran, how she loved the mornings. She would hum a tune and bustle about in the kitchen. We'd sit together at our country kitchen table for two, and like a sparrow in the sunshine, she would chirp and chirp as she pecked at her breakfast. Today I will tackle the library at the Caldwells, Molly. Oh, Molly, I wish you could see it. One day I'll have to ask Mr. Caldwell if I can bring you for a visit. It's a sumptuous room, full of dark leather and polished walnut, and so many books. And you wouldn't believe it, but they barely go in there. I love those books like my own. And today, it's dusting. It's tricky, let me tell you, dusting books. You can't just blow the dust off them like I've seen some maids do. That's not cleaning, Molly. That's merely dirt displacement. On and on she'd chatter, preparing us both for the day. I hear myself slurp my tea. Disgusting. I take another bite of crumpet and find I can't eat any more. I throw out the rest, even though it's a horrid waste. I clean my dishes and head to the bathroom for a shower,
Since Gran died, I do everything a bit quicker in the morning because I want to leave the apartment as soon as possible. Mornings are too hard without her. I'm ready. Off I go, out the front door and down the hall to Mr. Rosso's apartment. I knock firmly. I hear him on the other side of the door. Click. It opens. He stands with his arms crossed.
Molly, he says, it's 7:30 a.m. This better be good.
I'm holding the money in my hand. Mr. Rosso, here's $200 toward the rent. He sighs and shakes his head.
The rent is $1,800 and you know it.
Yes, you are correct, both about the amount that I owe and the fact that I know it. And I'll produce the rest of the rent by the end of today. You have my word. More head shaking and bluster.
Molly, if it weren't for how much I respected your grandmother...
End of day. You'll see, I say.
End of day, or I take the next step, Molly. I evict you.
That won't be necessary. May I have a receipt registering proof of payment for $200?
Now? You have the nerve to ask for that right now? How about I get it to you tomorrow, once you're all paid up?
That's a reasonable compromise. Thank you. Have a good day, Mr. Rosso. With that, I turn and walk away. I arrive at work well before 9. As usual, I walk the whole way to avoid unnecessary spending on transit. Mr. Preston is standing on the top step of the hotel entrance behind his podium. He's on the phone. He sets the receiver down and smiles when he sees me. It's a busy morning at the entrance, busier than usual. There are several suitcases outside the revolving door, waiting to be carried to the storage room. Guests hurry in and out, many of them taking photos and chattering about Mr. Black this and Mr. Black that. I hear the word murder more than once, said in a way that makes it sound like a day at the fair or an exciting new flavor of ice cream.
Good morning, Miss Molly,
Mr. Preston says.
Are you all right?
I'm quite fine, I say.
You got home safely last night, I hope.
I did, thank you. Mr. Preston clears his throat.
You know, Molly, if you ever have any problems at all, remember that you can count on good old Mr. Preston for help.
His forehead furrows in a curious way. Mr. Preston, are you worried?
I wouldn't go that far, but I just want you to keep good company and to know that if ever you need, I'd be there for you. You just give Mr. Preston a wee nod, and I'll know. Your gran was a good woman. I was fond of her, and she was so good to my dear Mary. I'm sure things aren't easy without your gran.
He shifts his weight from foot to foot. For a moment he doesn't look like Mr. Preston, the imposing doorman, but like an overgrown child. I appreciate your offer, Mr. Preston, but I'm quite all right.
Very well,
he says with the tip of his hat. Just then a family with 3 children in tow and 6 suitcases demands his attention. He turns to them before I can say a proper goodbye. I weave my way through the throng of guests, push past the revolving door and into the lobby. I head straight downstairs to the housekeeping quarters. My uniform hangs from my locker door, clean and shrouded in protective film. I dial the code to my lock and my locker springs open. On the upper shelf is Giselle's timer. All that sand from an exotic faraway place. All that golden brass shining hope in the dark. I sense a presence beside me. I turn to find Cheryl peeking around my locker door, her face severe and downturned. In other words, her normal expression. I try cheery optimism. Good morning. I do hope you're feeling better today and that you were able to benefit from a day of respite yesterday, I say. She sighs.
I doubt you really understand, Molly, what it's like to have a condition like mine. I have bowel issues, and stress aggravates things. Stress such as a dead man discovered in my workplace. Stress that causes gastrointestinal dysfunction.
I'm sorry you were unwell, I say. I expect her to go away then, but she doesn't. She just stands in my way. The plastic wrap of my uniform rattles ominously as she brushes against it.
Too bad about the Blacks, she says.
You mean about Mr. Black, I say.
Yes, it's most dreadful. No, I mean too bad you won't get their tips anymore, now that Black's dead.
Her face reminds me of an egg, featureless and bland. Actually, I say, I believe Mrs. Black is still a guest in the hotel. She sniffs.
Sunitha's looking after Giselle in her new room. I'll oversee her work, of course.
Of course, I say. It's yet another ploy to steal tips, but it won't last for long. Giselle will talk to Mr. Snow. She will request that I look after her again. So for now, I'll hold my tongue.
The police are finished in the former Black suite, Cheryl says. They've turned it upside down. Quite a mess. You'll have to work hard to set it right. Not big tippers either, cops. I'll look after the Chens from now on. Wouldn't want you overworked.
How considerate, I say. Thank you, Cheryl.
She stands there for a moment longer, looking into my locker. I see her eyeing Giselle's timer. I want to gouge out her eyes because she's tainting it, just by looking at it with such envy. It is mine. It's my gift. From my friend, mine.
Excuse me, I say, and slam the locker door shut. Cheryl flinches. I best be off. I must get to work.
She mutters something unintelligible as I grab my uniform and head for the change room. Once I'm uniformed and I've replenished my trolley, I make my way to the main lobby. I see Mr. Snow at reception. He looks frosted over, like a sugar-glazed donut melting on a hot day. He beckons me to him. I'm careful to allow the hordes of guests to pass before me in my trolley, bowing my head to each as they pay me no mind. After you, ma'am, sir, over and over again. It takes me an extraordinarily long time to navigate the short distance from the elevator to the reception desk. Mr. Snow, my apologies. It's very busy today, I say when I arrive at the desk.
Molly, it's good to see you. Thank you again for coming to work yesterday. And today. Many employees would simply use recent events as an excuse to feign illness, to shirk their duties.
I would never do that, Mr. Snow. Every worker bee has her place in the hive. You taught me that.
Did I?
You did. It was part of your speech during last year's Professional Development Day. The hotel is a hive, and every worker in it is a bee. Without each and every one of us, there would be no honey.
Mr. Snow is looking past me into the busy lobby. It could use some attention. A child has left a sweater on one of the high-back chairs. A discarded plastic bag gusts up and then back to the marble floor as a busy porter sweeps past, wheeling a squeaky suitcase in his wake.
It's a strange world, Molly. Yesterday, I was worried that after recent unfortunate events, guests would cancel their reservations and our hotel would be empty. But today, the opposite has transpired. More guests are booking. Ladies' groups are coming in droves for high tea just to snoop around. Our conference rooms are now booked fully for the next month. It seems everyone's an amateur sleuth. They all believe they can waltz right into the hotel and solve the mystery of Mr. Black's untimely demise. Look at reception. They can barely keep up.
He is right. The penguins behind the counter punch furiously at their screens, call out orders for valets and porters and the doorman.
The Regency Grand has become a bit of a hotspot, Mr. Snow says, thanks to Mr. Black.
How interesting, I remark. I was just thinking about how one day can be so utterly grim and the next such a blessing. In this life, you just never know what's around the bend, be it a dead man or your next date.
Mr. Snow coughs into his hand. I hope he's not getting a cold. He comes closer and speaks in a whisper.
Listen, Molly. I'll have you know, the police are now finished with their investigation in the Black Suite. I hope they haven't uncovered anything unsavory.
If they have, I'll just clean it up. Cheryl told me I'm to start there today. I'll get right to it, sir.
What? I expressly told Cheryl to handle it herself. We're in no rush to rent out that suite again. We need to let everything die down a bit, so to speak. I don't want to cause you any more stress than you've already endured.
That's quite all right, Mr. Snow, I say. I find it more stressful knowing the suite is in disarray. I'll feel much better when it's back in order, all cleaned up as if nobody ever died in that bed.
Hush, Mr. Snow says. Let's not frighten the guests.
It's only then that I realize I've abandoned my inside voice. My apologies, Mr. Snow, I whisper, and then, loudly, for the benefit of anyone who may have been listening, I'm going to begin cleaning now.
a suite. Not any suite in particular, just whichever is on my roster.
Yes, yes, says Mr. Snow. Best be off then, Molly.
And so I depart, circumventing the many guests and heading for the social to pick up the morning papers and hopefully to see Rodney. He's behind the bar when I get there, polishing the brass taps. I feel a warm glow the instant I set eyes upon him. He turns.
Oh, hey,
he says, smiling a smile that I know is just for me, mine, and only mine. He holds a tea towel in his hands, pure white, not a spot on it. I didn't call you, I say, or text you. I figured we could wait to speak in person like we are now. But I want you to know that if I didn't follow the protocol you expected, I'd be happy to simply text you or call you at any time, day or night. Just let me know your expectations and I'll adjust. It won't be a problem.
Whoa, he says. Alrighty then.
He takes the crisp white towel and tosses it over his shoulder.
So, he says, did you get up to anything interesting last night?
I come in close to the bar. This time, I'll be sure to use my whisper voice. You are not going to believe this, I say.
Try me, he replies.
Giselle came to see me, to my house. She was waiting outside my building when I got home. Can you believe it?
Huh. What a surprise,
he says, but his tone is odd, as if he isn't very surprised at all. He picks up a bar glass and begins to polish it. Though all the glassware has been properly sterilized in the kitchen downstairs, he's wiping out every errant spot. I appreciate his commitment to perfection. He is a wonder.
So what did Giselle want? He asks.
Well, I say, that is a secret between friends. I pause, look around the busy restaurant to make sure that no one is paying attention. Nobody so much as glances my way.
Feeling gun-shy? He says.
There's a playful smile on his face, and I do believe he may be flirting with me. The very thought catapults my heart into double syncopation. Funny that you say that, I reply. Before I can think of what else to tell him, Rodney says,
we need to talk about Juan Manuel.
Guilt suddenly overcomes me. Oh, of course. I've been concentrating so much on Rodney and the excitement of our burgeoning relationship that I've all but forgotten about Juan Manuel. It's clear that Rodney is a better person than I am, always thinking of others and putting himself last instead of first. It's a reminder of how much he has to teach me, of how much I still have to learn. How can I help? I ask.
I hear the police are gone and that the black suite is empty. Is that right?
I can confirm that, I say. In fact, it won't be rented out for a while. I'll be cleaning it first thing today.
That's perfect, Rodney says.
He puts down a polished glass and picks up another. I figure the safest place for Juan Manuel now is the black suite, he says. The cops are gone.
The room won't be rented out again anytime soon. Not for lack of guest interest, though. Have you seen this place today? Every middle-aged, mystery-watching cat lady in town is roaming the lobby hoping to catch a glimpse of Giselle or whatever. Honestly, it's pathetic.
I promise you this. No curious busybody is getting into that suite, I say. I've got a job to do, and I intend to do it. Once the suite is clean, I'll let you know, and Juan Manuel can come in.
Great, Rodney says. Can I ask you for one more thing? Juan Manuel gave me his overnight bag. Would you mind putting it in the suite? Under the bed or something? I'll let him know it's there.
Of course, I say. Anything for you. And Juan Manuel. Rodney retrieves the familiar navy blue duffel bag from beside a beer keg and passes it to me.
Thanks, Molly, he says. Man, I wish all women were awesome like you. Most are much more complicated.
My heart, beating at double speed already, alights and soars into the air. Rodney, I ask. I was wondering. Perhaps one day we can go for ice cream together. Unless you like jigsaws. Do you like jigsaws?
Jigsaws?
Yes. Jigsaw puzzles.
If those are the choices, I'm more of an ice cream kind of guy. I'm a bit busy these days, but yeah, we'll go out sometime. Sure.
I pick up Juan Manuel's bag, sling it over my shoulder, and start to walk away.
Molly, I hear.
I turn around.
You forgot your newspapers.
He plops a large stack on the bar, and I heave them into my arms. Thank you, Rodney. You're too kind.
Oh, I know, he says, winking.
Then he turns his back on me to deal with a waitress and her order. After that deliriously delicious encounter, I head upstairs. I'm practically floating on air, but as soon as I'm outside the door of the former Black Suite, the gravity of memory pins me to the ground. It's been 2 days since I've been in this suite. The door seems bigger than it used to be, more imposing. I breathe in and out, gathering the strength to enter. Then I use my key card to buzz through, pulling my trolley in behind me. The door clicks shut. The first thing I notice is the smell, or the lack of smell. No commingling of Giselle's perfume with Mr. Black's shaving lotion. As I survey the scene before me, I see that all of the drawers and every piece of furniture are open. The pillows from the couch are on the floor, zippers splayed. The living room table has been dusted for fingerprints, and left like that, prints in flagrante. The surface looks a lot like the finger paintings I was forced to do in kindergarten, even though I hated getting my fingers soiled with paint. A coil of caustic yellow caution tape lies abandoned on the floor outside the bedroom door. I draw another deep breath and walk farther into the suite. I stand at the threshold to the bedroom. The bed has been stripped bare. No sheets, no mattress cover. I wonder if the police took the sheets away with them. This means I will be low on my bedding count and will have to justify the loss to Cheryl. The pillows have been flung akimbo, stripped of their cases, stains glaring like grotesque bullseyes. There are 3 pillows only, not 4. I suddenly feel a bit dizzy. I hold on to the door frame to steady myself. The safe is open, but there's nothing in it now. All of Giselle's and Mr. Black's clothes have been emptied from the armoires. And Mr. Black's shoes that were on his side of the bed are gone. The bedside tables have been dusted too. Unsightly prints thumbing up through the powder left behind. Perhaps some of them are mine. The pills are gone. Even the crushed ones on the floor have vaporized. In fact, the carpets and floors seem to be the one thing in the suite that have been properly cleaned. Perhaps the police vacuumed, sucked up the traces, the microfibers and particles of the Blacks' private lives, all caught in the confines of a single filter. I feel a cold shiver run through me, as though Mr. Black himself, in a ghostly vapor, were pushing me aside. Get out of my way. I remember the bruises on Giselle's arms. Oh, it's nothing I can't handle. I do love him, you know. That ghastly man bowled me over every time I crossed him in the suite or in the hallways, as though I were an insect or a pest that deserved to be quashed. I see him in my mind's eye, a vile, beady-eyed creature smoking a vile, malodorous cigar. I feel a pulse of anger beat at my temples. Where is Giselle supposed to go now? What is she supposed to do? I wonder as much about Giselle as about myself. Mr. Rosso issued more threats this morning. Pay the rent or get evicted. My home. This job. They are all I have left. I feel the prick of tears that I do not need right now. Good things come to those who work hard. Clean conscience, clean life. Gran always comes to my rescue. I take her advice. I hustle back to my trolley and put on my rubber gloves. I spritz disinfectant on the glass tabletops, the windows, the furniture. I wipe off all the prints, all the remains of the interlopers who have been in this room. I scour the walls next, addressing the scuffs and dings that I'm certain weren't here before the ungainly detectives arrived. I cover the mattress in immaculate white. I make the bed, letting the crisp sheets billow down. Polished doorknobs, coffee service replenished, clean drinking glasses with paper lids to vouch for their cleanliness. I work by rote, my body moving of its own accord. So many times have I done this, so many days, rooms, guests, blending together in a haze. My hands tremble as I polish the gilt mirror that faces the bed. I must focus on the present, not on the past.
I wipe and wipe until a perfect image of myself shines back at me. There is only one corner of the Black's bedroom left to clean, the dark corner beside Giselle's armoire. I take my vacuum and run over and over the carpet there. I inspect the walls closely, give both walls a thorough wipe down with disinfectant. There, erased. I survey my handiwork, and I see the suite restored. There's a pleasing citrus tang in the air. It's time. I have avoided the bathroom, but I can no longer. It, too, has been left in a state of disarray. The towels are missing, the tissues, even the toilet paper rolls, all gone. There's fingerprint dust on the mirror and around the bathroom sink. I spritz and spray. I polish and replenish. In this smaller room, which due to its function must be disinfected more aggressively, the acrid scent of bleach is so strong that my nasal passages sting. I flip the switch for the fan and hear that familiar clunking sound. I quickly turn it off. It's time. I remove my rubber gloves and throw them into my rubbish bin. I grab the small step stool from my trolley and set it up under the fan. I climb onto it. The fan cover pulls down easily. I push in two clips to release it completely. I gingerly place the cover beside the sink. I get back on the step stool and reach one arm up into the dark recess of the fan, farther into the unknown, until my fingertips connect with cold metal. I pull the object down and hold it in both hands. It is smaller than I thought it would be, sleek and black, but surprisingly heavy. Substantial. The grip is gritty, like sandpaper or a cat's tongue. The barrel is smooth, with a satisfying shine. Pristine, polished, clean. Giselle's gun. Never in my life have I held anything like this. It feels alive, though I know it's not. Who could blame her for having it? If I were her, had been treated the way she has by Mr. Black and others, well, it's no wonder. I can feel it, the power in my hands that makes me immediately feel safer, invincible. And yet she didn't use it, this weapon. She didn't use it on her husband. Where will she go now? What will she do? And what will I? I feel the gravity in the room change. The weight of everything pushes down on my shoulders. I place the gun on the sink, climb back up the stool, and replace the fan's cover. Back down the steps I go, then I take the gun again and carry it into the living room. It rests so nicely in the bowl of my hands. What will I do with it? How will I get it to Giselle? Then it comes to me. They say television is an idle pursuit, but I maintain that I've learned many a lesson from Columbo. Hidden in plain sight. I carefully put the gun down on the glass table, then go back to my trolley. I remove Juan Manuel's duffel bag. I head back to the bedroom, where I slide his bag under the bed. Then I return to the sitting room. I turn my attention to my vacuum cleaner, standing steadfast and at the ready right beside me. I unzip the vacuum bag and take out the dirty filter. I grab a brand new filter from my trolley and slip the gun inside it. I push the fresh filter into the guts of my vacuum. I zip it up. Out of sight, out of mind. I give the vacuum a shove forward and back. Not a sound does it make, my secret, silent friend. I pick up the dirty filter and am about to toss it into my rubbish bin when a dusty clump falls out and lands with a dull thud on the carpet. I look down at my feet where the carpet is now sullied with dust and grime. In the middle of the nest of dirt, something gleams. I crouch and take the object into my hand. I wipe away the grime. Gold, thick, encrusted in diamonds and other jewels. A ring. A man's ring. Mr. Black's wedding ring. Right there in the palm of my hand.
the good Lord gives and the good Lord takes away. I curl my fingers around it. It's as though my prayers have been answered. Thank you, Gran, I say to myself, because it's only then that I know just what to do.
Chapter 11. The gun is stowed in my vacuum cleaner. The ring is carefully wrapped in a tissue and tucked in the left cup of my brassiere, right by my heart. I clean as many other rooms as I can, as fast as I can, using my manual sweeper rather than my power vacuum. At one point, I meet Sunitha in the hallway. She startles when she sees me, which is out of the ordinary.
Oh, so sorry, she says.
Sunitha, is something wrong? I ask. Are you short on cleaning supplies? She grabs my arm.
You found him, dead. You are a very nice girl. Be careful. Sometimes a place seems as clean as fresh snow, but it's not. It's just a trick. You understand?
I immediately think of Cheryl cleaning sinks with her toilet rags.
I understand completely, Sunitha. We must always keep clean.
No, she hisses. You must be more careful. The grass is green, but there are snakes in it. And with that, she slithers a white towel in the air and then drops it into her dirty laundry pile. She looks at me with an expression that does not fit the repertory of any I understand. What has gotten into her? Before I can ask, she pushes her trolley away and into the next room. I try to put the odd encounter behind me. I concentrate on finishing as soon as I can so that I can skip out to lunch a few minutes early. I'll need every minute. It's time. I push my trolley to the elevator and wait for it to arrive. Three times the doors open and guests stare out at me, not making the slightest move to allow me to enter, even though there's plenty of room. The maid goes last. Finally, the doors open and the elevator is empty. I have it to myself all the way down to the basement. I hurry out with my trolley and almost collide with Cheryl as I turn the corner toward my locker.
Where are you off to in such a rush? And how can you be finished with all those rooms so fast? She asks.
I'm efficient, I reply. Sorry, I can't dally. I have an errand to run over the lunch hour.
An errand? But you usually work straight through your lunch hour, Cheryl says.
How will you maintain your A+ exceptional productivity score if you're running all over the place at lunchtime? I'm very proud of my A+ exceptional productivity score. Every year it earns me a certificate of excellence from Mr. Snow himself. Cheryl never completes her daily room cleaning quota, and my excellence bridges the gap. But as I look at Cheryl, I catch something in her expression that's always been there. But today, I can read it plainly. The curve of her upper lip, the disdain, and something else. I hear Gran's voice in my head giving me advice about school bullies. Don't let them push your buttons. At the time, I didn't understand that the buttons weren't literal. I understand it now. The pieces slide together in my head. Cheryl, I say, I am aware of my legal right to take a break and will do so today and any other day that I choose. Is that acceptable, or should I run it by Mr. Snow?
No, no, she replies. It's fine. I'd never suggest anything illegal. Just be back by 1 p.m.
I will, I say. With that, I'm off, zooming by her. I park my trolley outside my locker, grab my wallet, then race back up to the elevator and out the bustling front doors of the hotel.
Molly, Mr. Preston calls after me.